Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a community credit union with 21 branches and a full suite of digital services. WSECU supports 9 regional farmers markets across Washington State and invites listeners to enjoy the bounty of summer at their local market. More information at WSECU.org.
The streets around Harborview Medical Center are pretty deserted in the early morning. People who do happen by usually get treated to some classical music playing from the lamppost speakers. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is a special episode of Sound Effect from KNKX Seattle-Tacoma. Harborview is a cluster of pretty imposing buildings, and in the main one sits the emergency department.
Again, it's pretty quiet right now. Our busiest time of day is early to mid-afternoon.
Is this the calm before the storm?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's Chief of Trauma, Dr. Eileen Bulger. And don't let the quiet fool you. This ER is the only Level 1 trauma center serving an area covering 4 states and almost 100,000 square miles. At pretty much any moment, the place could break out in a flurry of activity.
So we had a girl just a few months ago who was involved in a cold water drowning.
Yeah, I'm stuck out here on a boat. Paddle boat. Yes, north of Bering, Three Tree Point.
Oh my God!
It's okay.
We're on the boat,
and the phone cut out, so we're treating it as a possible person's in the water.
Friends are reeling tonight after the body of a Bering man was pulled from Puget Sound overnight by the U.S. Coast Guard. He died, but his female companion was rescued.
They believe it is nothing short of a miracle that she is still alive. They say that the temperature of Puget Sound was 47 degrees this morning, and she wasn't breathing.
She came in after 2.5 hours of CPR in the field. By all accounts, she looked dead. Her heart wasn't working. She had a lot of acid in her blood, which is a bad sign. But because of sort of the way that Harborview works, we had about 2 years ago implemented a program to bring in a new technology called ECMO, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. So we had to make a very quick judgment. Do we think there's a chance that this is recoverable? She's had a long period of CPR, but she's very young. And so we thought we'd give it a try. Everybody thought I was a little bit crazy, I think, because we decided to put her onto ECMO and rewarm her.
Was that your call?
Yeah, it was my call, yeah. So we put her onto ECMO and rewarmed her, and actually were able to get her heart beating again after we got her temperature up, and really actually surprised us that not only did her heart fully recover, but her brain fully recovered. That was amazing for us, and it was a good example of how if you kind of concentrate high-end specialty resources, you can kind of start to do these things that are pushing the envelope a little bit.
Harborview has been pushing the envelope ever since it began as the 6-bed King County Welfare Hospital in 1877. It's still owned by the county and run by UW Medicine. The most dire cases come here, victims of accidents, burns, strokes, and crime. And there's a lot more to this place, too. Life and death stories, acts of heroism, the drama of social injustice. And they're all contained in this big Art Deco beacon atop Seattle's First Hill neighborhood. This hour on Sound Effect from KNKX, it's stories of Harborview Medical Center. At Harborview, it's not uncommon to find people who've been working there for decades, people who have shaped how the place runs. Harborview's lifers. Dr. Eileen Bulger trained under one of these individuals. His name is Dr. Michael Kopus.
He would carry a radio, and he would listen into the medic calls. And if he wasn't happy with what they were doing, he would call them and tell them to do something different. And if it was a really complicated case, he would often show up. So it might be the middle of the night. He would show up in the ED and jump right in and help out. And be like, where'd he come from? You know, because he's listening to the radio all the time. I mean, I don't know if he ever turned it off. So, you know, again, example of his commitment.
Today, Dr. Michael Kopus is 80 years old. He had to retire in 2013 after a stroke. Among other jobs, Kopus was director of emergency services for 35 years. On the job, Kopus was known to be very direct and to the point, When it came to taking care of patients, he held himself and his staff to fiercely high standards. People who worked with him either adored him or they walked the other way when they heard him coming down the hall. He dedicated himself to the practice of medicine as if it were a religious calling, and he helped change how trauma care is delivered in the Northwest, changes that continue to save lives today. Dr. Kopus's relationship with Harborview began when he was a child growing up in the Magnolia neighborhood in Seattle.
During World War II, there was a volunteer institution called Gray Ladies. My mother became a Gray Lady with her gray pinafore and her name stitched in or embroidered in red on the top of the bib, and she went to Harborview faithfully every Wednesday or Thursday afternoon, where she went to the floor that at that point in time was housing the people awaiting eye operations and ear, nose, and throat operations, and washed their feet so that when they got to the operating room, the stench would not overwhelm the surgeons. My memories of Harborview were that it was a dark place with green tile, sort of institutional bilious green tile, and had some remarkable smells or odors that wafted through the downstairs halls. Harborview's tradition of serving all comers dates back to its beginnings in the 1930s. So it attracted people who understood that principle and wanted to pursue it and felt that their professional skills would be well used in the service to people who were unable to compensate the physician for his care. And it was also a hospital where people of key ethnic backgrounds could be seen and not challenged.
He started his career at Harborview as a neurologist. He'd hang around in the emergency room looking for possible patients. And eventually, in 1974, he became director of emergency services.
The atmosphere was electric, truly magnetic. People enjoyed working with each other. People enjoyed their projects. And that enthusiasm was contagious down to the house officer, to the intern and the resident in medicine or surgery or orthopedist or neurosurgery or neurology or whatever it might be. So not only were people enthusiastic about what they were doing it well.
He says, much like today, Harborview back then was known as a place where new ideas were encouraged. In 1969, a Harborview doctor and a Seattle firefighter came up with the idea for Medic One, which trained firefighters to treat people in the field and turn the ambulances into mobile emergency rooms. It dramatically improved a patient's chance of surviving when they got to the hospital. Dr. Kopus was Medic One's medical director for many years. And then he had his own light bulb moment that changed emergency medicine in the Northwest forever. It was 1982, and he was in Sitka, Alaska.
It was a dark and stormy night.
He had just given a lecture and was at a restaurant ready to tuck into some fish and chips.
And as I sat down, interesting gentleman in some Oshkosh by gosh sat down next to me and sort of breathed heavily in my ear and said, "They're practicing your talk." My talk was on triage in the hospital. George has got his hands full.
George Longenbaugh was the town surgeon.
And then the phone on the wall rang, and the waitress, who was a very nice lady in the standard Alaska waitress uniform of white blouse, dark green skirt and gold bracelets, gold rings and a gold necklace, turned to the assembled patrons and said, "Is there a Kopas here?" And I said, "That could be me, ma'am."
A house had caught fire and several children were inside.
I grabbed my coat and we went, got in this rusted out Ford and drove over to Sitka Community Hospital, where George was managing a intubated child, and the child smelled a little crispy, like it was branding time at the OK Corral, and the child was burned terribly. So he was manfully manning a anesthesia machine, which was using as a ventilator, and he was busy resuscitating that child. And there were two more in the room.
The doctors knew they had to get the kids to Harborview's burn center, 850 miles away.
We didn't have any idea how we could do that, so I started on the phone calling every fixed base operator who chartered aircraft from Seattle to San Francisco, and finally got hold of some place in Corvallis, Oregon. We wrapped up the poor little child, 12-year-old girl actually, in clean sheets and took her out to the aircraft. So suddenly that Lear roared to full turbine power, and he released the brakes, and we shot up into the air. It was like riding in a F4. And the last thing I remember is looking down on the sick as we went straight into the air. And we headed south, and the child died over the Dixon entrance, which is the stretch of water between the Alexander Archipelago, which is southeast Alaska, and the Queen Charlotte Islands. So I said to the pilot, this child died, and he said, don't tell me that, because we'll have to land. We're over Canadian water. Tell me she died till we get to over U.S. water. So we didn't say another word till we got over the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Later on that day, I thought to myself, why in the living heck should a doctor, namely George Longenbaugh, a wonderful man that he was, have to spend a day or half a day on the phone trying to find transportation when it could be there if he just picked up the phone and dialed one number?
The idea was to fly trauma care directly to the patients, applying an airborne version of that same mobile emergency room model that the ambulances use, and then bring those patients back to Harborview. This was how Airlift Northwest was born.
It started off with a turboprop aircraft. It was a T-tailed Cheyenne 3, and it was the first airlift aircraft, and we made many trips to Sitka, many trips to Ketchikan. My wife was absolutely convinced there was no more live persons in Ketchikan or Port Angeles left because we'd taken them all to Seattle.
The calls were answered by a woman in Seattle's Smith Tower, who would then page Dr. Kopus.
And I had a gigantic cell phone, used to look like a brick. I had also a list of every fire department, every hospital emergency room, and many of the doctors in Alaska and Montana that I could call and say, this is what's going on. I need for you to pick up my crew, and this is what we need to do to get that patient ready to travel. So all that working together seemed to make sense at the time, and it's sort of the model that continues to this day.
Today, Airlift Northwest has airplanes and helicopters based from Olympia, Washington, up to Juneau, Alaska, and east in Yakima, ready to fly the sick and injured to help. They've now carried more than 100,000 patients from as far as western Montana to Harborview and other hospitals. In 2013, when Dr. Kopus had his stroke, his relationship with Harborview changed. He experienced his beloved hospital not as a doctor, but as a patient.
I learned that it is difficult to stay cheerful when the world is falling about your ears. I just stayed in one place in the bed and kept my mouth shut. I thought I did not need to editorialize on anything happening to me. I was so spoiled I became embarrassed.
At one point, Kopus was treated by one of his former students. He says the care he received was superb. Throughout his career, Kopus has trained hundreds of men and women how to be doctors.
The most satisfying part of that job was watching a person, young, still wet behind the ears, swagger into the ER, if it was a he, the she's just very quietly walked into the ER, and 4 years later they walked out capable of taking care of a dying patient and preventing that death. The most rewarding thing was seeing that growth. I still wish I was there. I get a very strong feeling. I can see each floor, and I know what's on each floor, and I say, I've been in that room. I took care of people in that room. I've been in that clinic. I wish I were there now doing something that I know how to do. And all of a sudden, I just had to give it up, and that would just cut my heart out, to be honest with you. I haven't gotten over it yet.
That was 80-year-old Dr. Michael Kopus talking to us from his home in Agnew, Washington, near Squim. He retired in 2013. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're focusing on a single institution, Harborview Medical Center. It's best known as the only Level 1 trauma center serving Washington, Alaska, western Montana, and northern Idaho. But it's also a respected research institution and an important safety net hospital. That's not to say it's perfect. Harborview has had its share of criticism for labor disputes and incidents of medical negligence. A few years ago, the prominent head of its burn unit had to give up his license after concealing conflicts of interest. But for many in the region, especially vulnerable populations, Harborview remains a lifeline. Immigrants and refugees from all over the world find their way there, specifically to the International Medicine Clinic. Dr. Kerry Jackson is the clinic's longtime director. He says no matter where his patients come from, they all have things in common.
In this clinic, everybody's been through warfare as a rule. Torture is prevalent. The loss of family and of culture, and even sometimes of your actual village or city, is a commonly shared theme. The fact that you're living in a country where you don't read or speak the language, that the housing situation is abysmal for families of any size at all of these things are shared by all these people.
Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing spent some time at the clinic, which sometimes sounds like the international terminal of a busy airport. Here is what she found.
It's a Wednesday morning in the clinic, a busy day for patients to be seen. A child from Ethiopia in a wheelchair, just finishing her appointment, is being guided out by her father. And another patient, a man from East Africa, is getting help from a medical assistant named Azeb Gabridekan.
So this gentleman happened to be speaking Tigrinya, so I have to make sure that he understands where he's supposed to go. Because without our help, you know, they would be lost.
Like all of the other medical assistants in this clinic, Azeb has her own immigration story. She's from northern Ethiopia, and when civil war broke out, she lost most of her family. She spent 14 days on the back of a camel, escaping to Sudan before coming to the United States. She shares her story with her patients to help calm them down and to build trust.
We are not only MAs, we are also social worker, I would say, or, you know, like, giving them instructions or making them feel good. And as soon as we talk like that, they feel like, oh, you guys are, you know, thank God that we saw you. Thank God we have you here, because we feel like, you know, we have somebody who can give us help.
Just down the hall, Dr. Kerry Jackson, the clinic's director, holds a stethoscope to the chest of 84-year-old Ban Kong, who is originally from Cambodia.
Your heart's beating nice and regular and at a reasonable rhythm. Sometimes your heart beats really fast and it's beating slower today.
Dr. Jackson has been taking care of Ban Kong for decades, and yet every conversation these two men have requires the presence of one of the many interpreters Harborview has on staff. Sometimes the interpreter is in person, and other times, like today, they're on the phone.
He said something about he's feeling better than before a little bit.
Is there anything else you think I should know, or do you have any questions for me?
He and I met in 1992, or no, 1990, actually. And we've been together ever since. He's near the end of his life now with bad lung disease. So he certainly taught me about various aspects of COPD and chronic infections in his lungs that we can't treat and how he manages that, and exposures, occupational exposures back home, all this stuff, and I'll always carry him with me.
This clinic takes care of immigrants and refugees with health problems that might require a little more attention than what a community health clinic could offer. Dr. Jackson says to treat this population and to do the work well, everyone here needs to be aware of people's personal histories and the trauma a patient endured.
So, for example, last night I did a lumbar puncture on a patient who's been through an incredible amount of trauma in her life. And at one point it was overwhelming to her and we had to stop just because she had a panic attack. And as she put it in her language, it all came back. And so often what we do in medicine as an attempt to help somebody can seem very constraining, confining, and painful, which parallels a lot of what they've been through. And that's where a history of trauma can unintentionally, unwittingly be triggered by an attempt to heal.
And hearing people's stories over all these years and seeing the evidence on their bodies of what other people did to them, what does it make you think about humanity and and how we treat each other?
Yeah. There are a couple ways to look at it, I think. When you travel, most people that go to remote parts of the world that are non-European see a level of poverty and a level of joy that they are always struck by. These people are so poor and they're so happy. What's going on here? These families are so functional and they're living on the street in Bombay. What's going on here? And I think that what you realize is that a privileged life with all of its attendant comforts, etc., in a very subtle, seductive way, robs you of your humanity. I'm not trying to make a case at all for the fact that people that have been through all of this stuff have a better life. But what they often do is they find joy in the cracks, and they are survivors. And I think so often when you're constantly thinking that you should have a better life than the one you've got, which is sort of the American malady, that you lose sight of your joy and what you actually have. And so I think what we get every day is a reminder of that. We see people who have found mechanisms for survival, who are very generous with us, who show us how to live with a certain amount of elegance and, what's the word I'm looking for? Contentment.
Dr. Carrie Jackson has been to many remote corners of the world. In the late 1960s and early 70s, after dropping out of high school and getting a GED, he hitchhiked across Europe, Iran, and into Afghanistan. He did graduate work in anthropology with his wife in central Nepal. He's hunted for medicinal plants with ethnobotanists in Burma and Uganda. His original plan was to have a career in global health, going here, there, and everywhere to help people. And then this job came along. In this back corner of the hospital, the world now comes to him.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're spending the hour at Harborview Medical Center. We're in Harborview Park, and to be completely honest, the people I'm with look crazy. That is, until you get to know them a little bit, starting with the ringleader of this operation.
My name is Tita.
Tita Begashaw wears a bright purple top and makes sweeping gestures as she talks, raising her arms toward the sky. She seems totally comfortable in her skin. Tita works at the information desk here at Harborview, but she also has another title, laughter coach.
Okay, let's do greeting laughter. You go around, handshake, and laugh. Look at each other. Hello, hi, sir.
About a dozen people make the rounds, shaking hands and doubling over. Occasionally, Tita will grab somebody by the hands and twirl them like they're on a dance floor. The Harborview Laughter Club meets twice a month, as it has for almost two decades. The hospital is an intense place, and this is one way doctors, patients, staff, and just regular people can blow off steam. Jamie Sapp is a research coordinator in cardiology here.
So I really enjoy it. The first time I came, I did feel a little awkward, you're just laughing at nothing, but the more you laugh, the easier it gets, and then you start to feel really nice, and walking back into work, I always feel much better.
When you laugh, no stress, it make you feel good. Laughter is a short distance between two people. Laughter is universal language. Humor is individual. Laughter is universal.
My name's Tom. I'm from SeaTac. I come up here every time from SeaTac to come to this exercise. It's a spiritual experience, to laughter. You know, there's a lot of reasons to laugh, but mostly it's just to laugh with the joy of the universe, the joy of being alive with other people in a group like this.
Tom, like a lot of people here, is drawn to the healing power of laughter. It's been shown to lower stress hormones, boost the immune system, and even decrease pain. But people are also drawn to Tita Begashaw.
Tita's a force of nature, there's no doubt about that. Absolutely.
Genoa Caldwell comes here from the retirement community down the street. She says she'll never forget the day that she first met Tita.
We were walking away from the Fry Museum, and as we walked across, "Hi, Tita!" out of cars. "Hey, Tita!" "Who is this woman?" And we met someone on the street, and they ran across the street, started hugging and kissing her, started hugging and kissing me, and I thought, "I don't even know them! Isn't this great?"
When you get to know Tita a little bit, like Tom from SeaTac has, you learn that her story is much more than a laugh track.
Tita's had some bad times in her life, but she has come out of those bad times with more positive energy, more affirming energy, more accepting energy.
I came to the United States in 1988, and then I moved in Seattle in 1994.
Tita was granted political asylum when she arrived. Her native Ethiopia was racked by civil war and political unrest.
So I don't want to go back.
Would it have been dangerous to go back? Or?
Yeah, it was not good. My younger brother was in jail for a long time, political reason, yeah. And I was very sad. It was tough, a lot of tough time in my life. You know, losing my mom and my younger brother in jail, and also my uncle. It was very tough, but passing through that life experience, the difficult time is over, it's gone. Now I'm here to celebrate my life.
The hardships give Tita a unique perspective on the stresses of working in a place like Harborview. And she's convinced by her own experiences that laughter really is medicine.
For me, when I laugh, I am able to support the family in the positive way. As a staff, we have to be high vibration to take care of your patient. When you feel good, you're able to support your patient in the positive way. You don't get stressed. Be here in the now. Look at being outside. Look at the clouds. Look at the wind. Open your arms. Say thank you. Here in the now. Be in the moment. Open yourself and love. Love.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're spending the hour with stories from Harborview Medical Center. The hospital is a major treatment center for people with mental illness, including those who have been involuntarily committed to inpatient care. That population tends to have especially complex issues and usually does not want to be there. So it takes a special kind of person to connect with those patients and understand what it's like to be in their position. A person, perhaps, who's been there themselves. In 2013, Harborview launched a peer bridger program, pairing up the patient with a peer who had once been hospitalized for mental illness. Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad went to Harborview to talk to some patients and peer bridgers. And a heads up, if you're sensitive to detailed conversations about mental health and you want to skip this story, it's about 8 minutes long.
When I get into a conference room at Harborview, there are two patients and two peer bridgers waiting to talk to me. But just by looking at them, it's kind of hard to tell who's who. There are no lab coats or patient gowns like you might picture in a normal hospital setting. Everyone's wearing normal clothes, and all of them greet me the same, with a smile and a warm handshake. And in the case of Amy Hasegawa, the first of the four I talked to, you might think she's the one here to offer advice.
My last job was as a peer counselor at the Crisis Solution Center that's run by DESC. And I did that kind of work as a peer for about 5 years.
But in fact, Amy is a patient here.
When I was about 27 in 1987, I had my first break. I was going to school at the UW, and I ended up becoming very psychotic, and I ended up slitting my wrists. And at that time, they diagnosed me as bipolar with psychotic features. So I've been living with mental illness all these years.
Amy says she's also spent time at Western State Psychiatric Hospital, has been to Harborview quite a bit over the years, and has gone through electroconvulsive shock therapy twice, which she says has resulted in some short-term memory loss. This most recent hospitalization, which came a couple months ago, Amy says, was for a new diagnosis, schizophrenia. For Amy, the struggle is twofold. One is battling the illness itself. The other is feeling like very few people understand what she's dealing with.
It's kind of a loaded thing, having a diagnosis with the stigma and everything, and just all the things you have to go through when you have a brain disease like that. I just think of the kind of alienation I felt.
But this time during Amy's hospitalization, there was someone new that became part of her rehabilitation.
My name is Nancy Dow, and I am a part of the peer bridger team that works in the hospital.
Nancy came at a time when I was pretty psychotic and having some negative thoughts about some of my family circumstances. And she navigated that with me, but I guess coming from the standpoint of someone with schizophrenia.
Nancy Dow, just like every other peer bridger, is not only there to be a resource for the patient, she's also there because she's been through her own battle with mental illness.
I was misdiagnosed for 20 years, from the time I was 16 until I was 36. And so I went all that time with terrible symptoms that weren't ever alleviated because they were treating the wrong condition. When I turned 36, I went to a doctor who diagnosed me correctly, treated with me with the correct medication, and I responded very, very quickly. It's not that I haven't had symptoms since then, but they've been manageable.
Nancy says that having gone through that herself is very important to connecting with a patient.
There's almost an instant understanding between peers when they realize that although I'm on staff in the hospital, I carry a diagnosis of a mental illness. I live with the effects of that, and I have been hospitalized. And that does create a link up. It is almost a magical process sometimes that people won't know what a peer bridger or peer specialist is, and I won't even get a complete sentence out of my mouth before they'll say, oh, you get it.
It's kind of like the kind of bond that the veterans have. It's kind of like that, because we have sort of like our war stories, but it creates a strength in us.
What a peer bridger does with and for the patient can vary. Terry Jo Putney has been a peer bridger for 5 years. She says a lot of the work happens after the patient leaves the hospital.
Sometimes they get foggy because they don't know where to go or how to get there, and teach them how to take a bus and a lot of them have feel intimidated by going to appointments and need somebody just to sit with them.
Terry Jo says the majority of the patients she works with are homeless, so she'll also work with them to figure out their housing or maybe find them a prepaid cell phone. But at the heart of this program is the empathy between peer bridger and patient. Melanie Bell is a patient who was involuntarily committed and is in inpatient recovery.
A person that I thought was a friend of mine saw me going through what my doctor would call a manic state. I was sort of pouring out art. This person likens themselves an artist. They came in and saw my work and thought I was going crazy because I was doing something they had never been able to do. They then called my sister, who I haven't spoken to in 5 years, and had me involuntarily committed, lied to my mother, and she came along and, of course, was very worried when, you know, my friend and my sister were saying I was going crazy.
Part of the process of involuntary commitment is having a judge sign off on it. And while Melanie has been skeptical of some of her treatment, she says her relationship with her peer bridger, Carissa, is key to her recovery.
She's a woman of color, and she's a woman of color who's been through the social services system. She would go with me to appointments. She would make sure that I had phone numbers and applications met and would constantly be on my other caregivers and telling them she doesn't have this, she needs this, she needs this, over and over. I would watch her. I would come in for an hour appointment and she would talk to three of my so-called caregivers and make sure that they were on the ball. It's the only way you can recover is if you have someone like Carissa on your team.
And the numbers seem to back that up. A study done after the first 2 years of the Peer Bridger program showed that patients in it saw a reduction in hospital days by more than 3 weeks. Enrollment in outpatient mental health services jumped from 29 to 70%, and enrollment in Medicaid nearly doubled. But Peer Bridgers like Terry Jo Putney say success for them is hardly statistical. She recalls a moment with a patient she says she'll never forget.
I took him down to the Goodwill and got him a sleeping bag. You know, he was just almost in tears that he got something warm to sleep out, and this is the middle of the winter. And that, to me, was the most joyful thing, to see him so excited that he got not a brand new sleeping bag, but a sleeping bag. And so I just talked to him just a little bit ago, and he told me that, and this was over a year ago that I worked with him, and he says, Terry Jo, I want you to know I still have that sleeping bag. Even though he has housing, he says, I still have my sleeping bag. And so that to me is so precious, you know, that the little things that we can do for them, they're very appreciated.
That story from Sound Effects, Kevin Kniestad. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to a special hour of Sound Effect, all about Harborview Medical Center. Harborview is a center for research across a bunch of different fields, and among others, it houses the headquarters for the University of Washington's Department of Global Health. The department has tendrils that reach into practically every corner of the planet. Just one guy, Dr. Judd Walson, has worked extensively in Thailand, Nepal, Kenya, Bangladesh, Ethiopia. Walson also sees patients and treats infectious diseases. But just how he ended up here, well, that's quite a story.
I have a lot of young students come to me and sort of want me to help them plan their career path and want to know how I did it and how they can do it. And it's just interesting to look back and realize how I could never in a million years have planned it the way it turned out.
Judd Walson started on that path not because he grew up wanting to be a doctor. In fact, he grew up wanting to be a magician.
By the time I was in my early teenage years, I was performing at local birthday parties for kids and things of that nature, and was hired by some magicians out of Florida when I was, I believe, 15, to travel from Florida to California and back for a summer. And really, that was my first experience with what it would be like to actually semi-professionally do magic. I think fundamentally it was mostly about the response I got from other people and just the surprise and the ability to really make other people smile, not in the way that a comedian makes people smile and laugh, but really to recognize sort of the magic in the world around them and that there's something unexplainable. My plans in high school could probably be summarized best as saying that I had no plans in high school. I really wasn't really sure I wanted to go to college. So I actually left and I ended up going to England and rapidly figured out that I wasn't going to survive very long on the very little amount of money I had. And so because I had this history of doing magic, I decided to go try street performing. So I spent the next 7 months or so in Europe, traveling all over Europe from Scandinavia to Italy and Greece and all through Central Europe and Western Europe, just street performing. And there wasn't anything future, past driving me. It was really sort of a living day-to-day, moment-to-moment in a really wonderful, free way. And I remember that was just really exciting. I think I also, though, working on the streets was a lot of exposure to people who didn't have long-term plans, as I said, was a positive, but also started to become a negative. And I started to really feel as though this wasn't a life that I could see myself pursuing forever. I can remember we were in Brussels, Belgium. We ended up going around to some other street performers and asking them if there was a cheap place to stay. And one of them said, oh, you can just come back and stay with me. And we got in his van and we ended up driving through this forest sort of in the dark. And we sort of arrived at this house in the middle of a pretty dark street. And he said to us, no, my mom lives upstairs, so just be quiet and we'll get settled downstairs. So we went in and I remember this incredible overwhelming smell of being in a hospital. So we went to sleep, and when I woke up in the morning, the entire apartment was just littered with ether bottles. And it turned out that he was addicted to sniffing ether. And he had been in prison for auto robbery before and had been addicted to heroin before that. And I think I remember, that was one moment where I remember thinking, wow, this is a really tough life. And I think that was the moment when I sort of was done with the street performing.
Judd Walson went back to college and, inspired by his travels, took up cultural anthropology. That led him to Nepal as part of a study abroad program. He fell in love with the place and returned there after graduating to continue his research.
A lot of these communities were, you know, days walk from the nearest road, so they were quite remote. These are villages with no running water, no electricity. Many people at that time who had never actually seen electricity or a bicycle or a car. And there were really, really limited amounts of grain and other food production. And so we saw tremendous amounts of malnutrition among children particularly. And I think I started to think about whether I wanted to be someone who described things, a descriptive scientist like an anthropologist, or if I wanted to be someone who intervened and actually tried to change things. One day we were on our way up to one of the more remote villages, and when a guy came running down the path who I knew, and he was sort of in a panic, and he said that, you know, his wife had been gored by a yak and she was 8 months pregnant. Despite the fact that at that point I had no medical training, because I was working with health-related projects, I think there was sort of an expectation that I would know what to do. And so for the next, you know, almost day, I sort of rushed up the mountain with Danu to go see what we were going to do for his wife. And that whole time, I can just remember in my head this terrible feeling of uncertainty as to what I could possibly offer and what was going to confront me when I went into this hut and found this woman who'd been gored by a yak who's pregnant, and just a real feeling of helplessness and paralysis. We got there and she had been gored through the leg and pretty severe wound, but we were able to sort of stabilize the bleeding and get her down to the capital, and she delivered a healthy baby and, you know, on term. And that period of trying to get up to the village and feeling all the thoughts going through my head made me realize that, you know, you don't go into global health because you intend to do well. It's not enough. You go into global health or global development I think, with a real desire to understand how you actually can make a difference and to have the skills to do that. And I think that was an experience that really, I think, highlighted for me that I really needed to do more than want to do something good for others. I had to learn the skills to do it.
That realization gave Walson a clarity that he hadn't had before. He applied to medical school with a special concentration in public and global health. And that, in turn, took him abroad once again.
So after all of this, I ended up moving to Kenya for almost 3 years. And I was starting to help set up some pediatric child HIV clinics in Africa. And it was quite stressful. There were a lot of kids dying. You know, a mother losing a child is the same everywhere. It is so painful. And that pain is no different for a woman in Kenya than it is for a woman in Seattle. But what's different is the expectation of what's going to happen to the child. So here, I think all of us, if our child became severely ill, we would take them to Children's Hospital or Harborview or wherever we go with the expectation that our child will recover. And when a child doesn't recover, it's quite shocking in the U.S. And in many parts of the world, because that's not the case, the expectation is different. There is a lot of uncertainty about how likely it is that your child will recover, what that even means. And that's something we can change. That's something we can change. And so I think we, you know, really helping other people get to a place where they don't have to live with that sort of uncertainty is something that's really quite important. I think in any of our lives, much of our ability to convince others comes not only from our expertise and our education and our resume and all of those things, but there's a large component of our ability to tell stories and to engage people in the stories that we tell. And in global health, I think a lot of what we do is convincing people that global health should be a priority and that we should care. When you're performing magic, you have to believe what you're doing. That's sort of the critical component of misdirection, is that your own mind is following not what's happening behind the scenes, that's the trick, but it's following what you want the audience to believe is happening on stage. So you almost have to get into a mindset where you believe exactly what you want the audience to believe and carry them along with that story. And I think that that translates when I'm speaking with people and having to hold an audience's attention and bring them along and get them engaged is a really big part of why I've been able to do the same in global health, get people excited, get people engaged and motivated to make a difference in the world.
Judd Walson is a professor at the University of Washington and a clinician at Harborview. And yes, he says he does still know a few card tricks. That's it for this special edition of Sound Effect. You can see a slideshow of historical photos of Harborview at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. Our show is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Janae Janik. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Special thanks this week to Susan Gregg, Emma Jones, Sunny Levin, Nathan and Allison Bays, Dr. Pat Fleet, and Dr. Audrey Young, whose book about Harborview is called The House of Hope and Fear. Clips of news audio came from Cairo 7. Our summer encores begin next week, starting with the theme, What Are the Odds? I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is a production of KNKX.